Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey everyone, it's Tom here. Just a quick note, we taped this episode of Pack Your Knives with a heavy heart, and I just want to acknowledge at the top that we care about the racial injustice in this country, and we're sickened by the police brutality that has torn our communities apart. If you're looking for places to support, we have a couple for you to consider that hit close to home. Kevin, my co-host, he shared on his Instagram a cause in his home state, the New Georgia Project, whose goal is to register all eligible unregistered citizens of color in Georgia by the end of the decade. Check that out at newgeorgiaproject.org. And also for me, I want to spread the word about Full Court Peace. It's a nonprofit group based in Fairfield County, Connecticut. It's where I grew up, the epicenter of one of the largest income gaps in America. And that group, Full Court Peace, seeks to bridge previously divided communities around the world through basketball. So as always, we thank you for listening. And with that, let's try to have some fun.
Tom, what on this earth would you pay $3,000 a pound for?
Certainly some better truffles than what we saw in this episode, Kevin.
This is Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, the upset of all upsets this week.
Oh, man.
Top chef favorite, Chef Gregory, out. Melissa cooking flawlessly, but I mean, the story is not so much the win as the loss. I am shocked. I am floored. I feel terrible. I know what back difficulties feel like.
Yeah.
Tom, am I being overly charitable, blaming it on the back? I mean, what is your interpretation? Give us your read of your top pick and top chef favorite, Chef Gregory, going down.
Wow. Stunning. Kind of got those vibes from the start of the show. He did not look good. He did not look good from the flight, the whole, all the confessionals there at, trying to stand up on his own two legs. I just kept thinking, you know, I can't imagine Gregory's going to go home. And when it hit, I was just like, that just happened. You know, when like, you know, when you like, you, like when the Cleveland Cavaliers won the 2016 finals, you were like, it's never going to happen. The stars aren't going to align where they're going to come back from down 3-1. And they actually did it. And when it happened, you're just like, this is really happening right now. That's kind of what I had with Gregory going down, was like, wait a minute. I don't think I was fully emotionally prepared for Gregory to go home. And I'm trying to think, Kevin, what is the NBA equivalent of a champion or someone who's destined to be a champion, but went out with an injury and just everything fell apart? Like, what is the comp for Gregory having a back injury in the finals?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I can think of really profound upsets, the 94 Sonics losing to Denver. And I was in Seattle then. But I think I just can't, you know, like obviously Scotty's back injury. I mean, the Steve Nash kind of lying on the sideline. I'm trying to think of one where sort of an in-game injury just torpedoed the chances, and I can't come up with one.
Yeah,
right now.
This is really hard to wrap my head around. Is Gregory, not just in this season, Kevin, but in his previous season in Top Chef Boston, when May just ran the table there at the end against Gregory, he had, here are the stats, Kevin, 9 challenge wins in 27 episodes on Top Chef. One out of every 3 episodes that he was a part of in Top Chef history, he won the damn challenge. He won 6 quick fires in addition to that. So in 27 episodes, he was a winner on 15 of them. And he was a winner on this episode too. And he was out because I think back problems are a bitch.
They really are. I mean, I hope at some point we can have Greg on this podcast. I want to talk to him about the amazing world of microdiscectomies, which I endured last August, which was actually a really successful back procedure. But he will go down. I mean, what's interesting is what you say, and I was thinking this. This will still go down as one of the great individual performances in any season, irrespective of the fact that he did not make the final four. This is, I mean, again, I'm
with you.
Wow,
he didn't make the final four?
He did not make the final four. I mean, this is truly, these are those Sonics. And I just think that, again, we will look back on what was just an absolutely dominating season. I mean, this is someone who I many times says plays error-free ball. And to the admission of the chefs, like, this was not a bad dish. I mean, in some ways, were it not so savory and flavorful and just teeming with just spice and dominant flavors, he might have pushed through. I mean, what was so interesting about this challenge, Tom, was it was the ultimate curveball. This was a discipline challenge, right? In fact, the more savory your food, the more dangerous it is to put in front of the judges. And I think it was a discipline challenge, and I don't think it's a coincidence that the two cleanest chefs, or let's say the chefs with the two cleanest sort of approaches in Melissa and certainly Valtaggio,
yep,
finished toward the top. But this was just such an – it was an odd episode. It was a little bit unsatisfying, and as much as I think we all love Tuscany, clearly the contestants were jet-lagged.
Oh, my God. You know, they look just awful. They look – like, what do you think happened there? Like, do you think they traveled all day? You've done these flights before, Kevin. Is it that it looked like they were waking up at the crack of dawn to do this aperitivo, and they looked like they were zombies?
Yeah, and you saw, I mean, Gregory is so effervescent in his interviews. I mean, I love when he's talking to the camera on this show.
Like, yes.
He's benevolent, but he's positive and confident. I like the manner in which he just kind of speaks about the entire ethos of the show when you get him on camera. And it was just like these heavy eyelids behind those aviator glasses. And it was just like, this is not a man at 100%. This is not a man at 75%. Again, not offering excuses, but this is not the Gregory we know. I mean, this is Pippen as a decoy. In that game 6,
Utah in 98. Yeah,
this was not a thing. The aperitivo was a somewhat interesting challenge. Again, it's unusual that at the finale week or the finale portion of the show, they cook for a larger crowd. I mean, typically this is the moment in the competition where the arena shrinks as the stakes go up.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to do this this aperitivo, which is essentially just a bar snack. And, you know, Kevin kind of very on his game, did that really savory polenta. Voltaggio, not on his game with the lamb tartare with the gremolata that he just over garlic because he clearly just didn't have much of a game plan after it all blew up. Melissa, Tom, is just flawless right now. Oof. I mean, just flawless. I'm going to beer steam some mussels. I'm going to pickle them to kind of, you know, give it the required acid. I'm going to work in the Peroni beer as part of kind of the steam. I'm in awe of her game right now.
She's got it all together. She never looks stressed. She never looks like she's on the brink of losing it. And she's got, you know, when we go into Tuscany, we know that they have these breaks where they're able to kind of craft recipes and know, all right, here's my homework. I'm going to Tuscany. What are the flavors I need to prepare for? What are the dishes I need to study and master before I go over there? And I don't think you can really prepare for what she had, right? It's a mussel dish that she has basically pickled. And it's not something that you would identify as a super Tuscan dish. So she's creating this dish on the fly in an extremely short amount of time. And, you know, she's not getting more sleep than everybody else. She's under the same conditions, and yet she seems like she has just got everything together. And by the way, I should mention before we continue, we're going to have Vince Mancini on this show. He is the top chef power ranker on Up Rocks. And we're going to go through in the second half of this podcast, go through not just this episode a little bit, but the whole season and go through it with him. He I'm sure has some takes on this episode, but more so Melissa and Gregory just seemed like they were flawless this season. But with the back injury, Melissa has definitely separated herself from the pack.
I mean, I think she's able to pull it off because it's just not overthought. I mean, she has basically, you know, how is this going to taste and how can I streamline the process without sacrificing any creativity? And that's just her MO in every single challenge. I mean, with the exception, again, unless she's like, I mean, basically cooking out of a freaking Smart and Finer cooler at a summer camp or something. I mean, where she's just left with bagged lettuce. But apart from that, I mean, it's just there's such a simplicity of approach. And yet, again, with wonderfully complex outcomes. And I want to talk about Voltaggio for a second.
I was just going to say, Voltaggio you think would be the same, but he was really struggling on this quick fire. And you never really see Mel struggle like this, even though they seem like, you know, kindred spirits in the cooking fashion.
He's just not a quick fire guy. And I think what's funny is you can almost sense – like he's – so, I mean, let's face it. With the exception of – look, it's helpful to have immunity. You like to win the $10,000 or whatever prize or incentive they offer for a quick fire win. I think a guy like him who's been on the show multiple times, who's absolutely competent in his cooking, he kind of knows it doesn't matter. Like at the end of the day, quick fire does not, again, other than the material benefits of winning a prize, a cash prize, or I get to pick first, which by the way, and I mean, shit, Tom, half the time, the thing you get for winning Quickfire isn't much of an advantage, as you pointed out statistically, or be careful what you wish for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, I just think about Taggio being so technically oriented as a chef. For him, it's just like he just doesn't give a shit at this point, right? He doesn't do it defiantly. He's not arrogant or obnoxious about it. But it's just so clear that he just doesn't regard winning a Quickfire as essential to his progress and his prosperity on this show. Like it just doesn't matter to him. I'm gonna throw something against the wall. Oh, the lamb isn't gonna work. Okay, I'll just do a tartare. Oh well, it sucked. Next.
Yeah.
And now I'm gonna go cook the main event and You know, I'm going to have a much better focus on the challenge. I'm going to have more time to do the kinds of food that I do. And it's why I've thought for the last several weeks, Tom, I think Voltaggio is a sleeper going into the final couple of episodes. I really do. I think as we get closer and closer, the parameters of these challenges, especially the elimination challenges, appeal to his sensibility.
Yeah, and I'm sitting here thinking it's kind of like the regular season in the NBA. Not to say that winning 60 games isn't a good thing for your chances to win it all, but you know, the Milwaukee Bucks won 60 games last year and they got outed. You know, the was it 2016 Atlanta Hawks when they won 60 plus games and they got outed, and it seemed like LeBron was just like, yeah, you can go win your 60 games, but as long as I show up in the playoffs, we're going to be good. And I think that's kind of the thing with Brian Voltaggio is there's no real cost if you screw up in quickfire.
No.
You know? So I think he realizes, like, if I screw up the lamb, whatever. And that's kind of been his MO on this show to a comedic magnitude that he just doesn't do quickfires very well. And I want to give a quick shout out to Padma for being fluent in Italian.
That was wonderful.
What was – I had no idea.
Interesting woman in the world.
I mean, she really is. She just pulled that out of her back pocket, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to speak fluent on y'all. And I was like, whoa. So that was impressive. And I really liked this Filippo Saporito?
Oh, he was charming.
whatever they did in the square, it looked like they were sleep-deprived more so than ever. And Voltaggio just – you know, he was, once again, the quickfire wasn't his thing. Gregory, just to shift to Gregory here, he wanted to do the clams, and I thought it was impressive that he was able to shift in 30 minutes, completely shift the protein to a cuttlefish because the clams were sandy. And that kind of sucks. Like, when you get your ingredients and you open them up and they're bad, like, I feel like that's not fair. And he was able to come out with one of the top three dishes.
Yeah. Stephanie's, by the way, looked like the ideal version of Stephanie's is delicious, right? A venison gargonzola and carrozza. I mean, it's just this deep fried sandwich of yummy cheese and meat, right? I mean, the one thing I did is I thought it was interesting. Do we know that she absolutely had to cut it down and make all 30 sandwiches separately because the focaccia was uneven? I would love to, you know, get her on and kind of ask because I don't. Do you have to? I mean, so maybe some are just a little differently proportioned than others. There's probably something I'm not understanding here, but it was just something I wonder that if she had had a more, you know, had she had more time and sort of just said, oh, screw it. I'm going to make a full slab and then just cut them in 30 portions. I do wonder if, and I'm sure there's an explanation I just don't understand, but it was disappointing. And, you know, so Stephanie's kind of interesting because she, unlike Voltaggio, I think quick fires are very important to certain kinds of contestants on the show. I think contestants that thrive off of a jolt of confidence. Wow, I'm cooking well. Chefs that are momentum chefs, you know, the streak shooters, if you will, Tom, although I know that's an entirely different philosophical debate, whether there is such a thing as a streak shooter. But, you know, Stephanie is someone, unlike Voltaggio, who I think really thrives on whatever energy she gets from cranking out a good quick fire. But, you know, Kevin won it. He's really good at the sort of savory, yummy polenta thing. He made a great choice. You know, Gregory, as you said, had a great recovery, you know, because at the end of the day, like this chickpeas and saffron cooked in beer. I mean, you know, you can switch out one shell fish for another and it's going to work. Melissa, of course, we talked about her. It's in a brilliant minimalism with that challenge. But I find the white truffle challenge to be fascinating again for all the reasons I mentioned, which is it was almost as if like your strength could be used against you at the judges' table.
Yep. Yep. It's almost like I had a problem with this one, Kevin, because you saw Gregory like shave the entire like pound of truffle on his dish. And then they complained that there wasn't enough truffle or at least there was not enough flavor. So I'm sitting here being like, man, we paid they found $3,000 worth of truffles that morning. And he's just putting on so much of those flakes, those white truffle shavings onto his dish. And they kind of dinged him for having a really good dish that was too flavorful for the truffle. And I'm sitting here like, man, I feel like we should either have some more powerful truffles, or maybe we shouldn't be putting so much weight into these truffles if they can't really come through.
No, I mean, I think what makes the truffles special is how mysterious they are. And I think one of the judges beautifully characterized it, which is, I think they're very temperamental. If they see an ingredient they don't like, they run away. Like, you can you can drop a freaking crate load of truffles on that stew, but if there are flavors that compete with it or that offend it, metaphorically speaking, the truffle, it doesn't matter how much shit you put on it. I mean, you are not going to taste it. And I think that was sort of the sophistication of the challenge. And it's, I imagine if you don't work with white truffles, it might not be something you intuitively know. And I mean, that's sort of what did in Gregory. It's not a matter of, oh, you can just, you know, shave them on top. If there are flavors in your dish that are going to compete, they will, it doesn't matter. You could put a pound and a half. By the way, I welcome anybody, any listener who knows, like, I mean, Tom, I'm sorry, there's nothing in the world that sells for $3,000 a pound where there isn't a vast underworld / black market / criminal operation / some shady fucking shit that that governs the distribution or mining or whatever. Like, I now, like, someone somewhere has written the Great New Yorker article or book on the shit, a Misha Glennie book, like the McMafia book on like the underworld of white truffles. Because now I'm fascinated. I'm sorry, you can't just let out a couple of fucking dogs into the woods that within an hour can accumulate, you know, tens and thousands of dollars worth of a raw material.
I hope those dogs are getting shady shit. Yeah. I hope those dogs, Kevin, have some like palatial estate that they like, some dog house that they live in, because like that is incredibly cheap labor. They just get these beagles who just dig up $3,000 worth of gold. Think about this. Those beagles.
Like, who owns that land? I mean, is that, like, I want to know the story of that plot. I mean, anywhere where there is a raw material or a commodity that
they're just
that
walking
sells
in the park. They're just like, oh, hey.
I mean, by the way, I mean, you don't think there are freaking armed guards around that lot? I mean, I'm dying to know more about the underworld of truffles, because, sorry, it's too valuable of an asset for there not to be. Human beings are human beings, and there's some funky shit going on, literally and figuratively, with the truffle market. So this is my new homework, like during this epidemic, because I'm going to find out more about the Italian truffle underworld.
Yes, you mentioned Kevin, white truffle is temperamental, and I have it underlined in my notes. White truffle is temperamental! ! And I really felt like this with these Italian chefs that they were getting judged with.
Hilarious, by the way.
Oh my god. They were amazing. Nothing that they did was good. They were some tough, harsh critics. Maybe it's just, you know, when you look at like Stephanie, for example, the Radicchio is one of the top chef great debates. Is if you go into a elimination challenge and you know one of your elements on your plate is bad, straight up bad, but you told the judges that you were going to have it on your plate, what should you do? Should you mask it? Should you just ditch it altogether? Or should you just put it on there because that was the plan? And they hated that Radicchio.
No, it was very interesting. You want to talk about the losers first or the winners?
Let's go with the losers. Okay, let's go with losers. The Gregory, Wild Boar, Stephanie with the Mezzaluna with the Radicchio, and Kevin with
the meatball, the polpette, but meatball with the onion chestnut.
If he doesn't have a meatball restaurant, what is he doing? The croquette and the meatballs, I feel like every round he just makes a bomb.
He likes
meatball.
He likes food balls. So it was interesting because of the three bottom chefs, and that was Kevin, Stephanie, and Gregory. Kevin had the least appealing dish overall. Stephanie made the most specific error, kind of the least appealing ingredient that overpowered. But Gregory was the least truffly, even though he might have had the best. Actually, no, I think they specifically said Stephanie was the dish they'd eat again. And I thought that was interesting. So they each, because, one of the things Gail had said is, look, they all made the same error. And the answer is yes, but error is a different degree. Again, are you going to send home the chef that was least faithful to the challenge, the chef who gave you the shittiest dish, or the chef who made the most specific and glaring error. And they clearly chose, Tom. They chose. They said it was the least truffly, because you know that stew was delicious.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, it's Gregory. Like, the guy doesn't make food that doesn't taste good. I mean, even Melissa's had some stuff that doesn't taste good. Gregory, like one of the defining features of Gregory's food is this shit is going to taste good. Irrespective of whether or not maybe there's a little much too heat in a challenge you don't want heat, or maybe it's a little this, or it is always going to taste good. And to watch him go home for a dish that was delicious, but just didn't pay tribute to the showcased ingredient was really interesting. Whereas he was up against chefs at the judges' table who made far more fatal errors to their primary dish.
And you would say this is kind of Top Chef. This is the dilemma of Top Chef, is like part of the magic of this show is that they come up with these challenges that you have to excel in the challenge, not excel in cooking. It's both of those things. And he excelled in the cooking. And I guess you can knock him on not putting the truffle first in terms of the priority of that dish. You know, I think this is a local Tuscan dish that he put together. He said he had a recipe, or he read somewhere about this wild boar recipe with the polenta and the tomatoes, this stew. But maybe he tried to just smush those two elements together. He's like, I don't know if truffle is going to work here, but I do know that this is a masterful dish that I can nail, and it's Tuscan. And to the same thing that Stephanie – I thought it was one of the most hilarious moments on the show. This episode is when the woman just goes, "You made pasta? I eat pasta all the time. Why are you going to make pasta for us?" And I know that there's that dilemma too, Kevin, in Top Chef, in the annals of Top Chef. It's like when you go to their home court, are you going to try to play their game, or are you going to try to show them something different? And Stephanie had that change of heart of like in the middle of the night, she realized, why the fuck am I not doing a pasta? I'm going to do a mezzaluna pasta, which, by the way, there's a beet mezzaluna pasta at one of my favorite restaurants. It's Maculina in South Beach in Miami. Mike Perello, the chef, does this mezzaluna that as soon as Stephanie said mezzaluna, I was like, oh, I want to go back to Miami right now. It's an amazing dish. She did a great job, but she was dinged by that guest for actually daring to make pasta when you're in Italy. And I guess maybe, Kevin, what I'm coming down to here is maybe they didn't cook their food. They tried to cook a Tuscan dish that they thought they would impress the judges, but it wasn't necessarily a Gregory dish. Like, it wasn't something that screamed Gregory. And maybe...
Oh, see, I disagree. I think it was a fundamentally Gregory dish. I mean, that was the problem, right? I mean, this is what he does. He does, like, I guess, the wild boar and chocolate stew. And listen, whatever bitchy guest says about, like, I don't know, like, don't make pasta. I mean, I think it was the right move for her. She has demonstrated that she has become a great maker of pasta. You know, I think, you know, doing a squash mezzaluna and a porcina brodo, mezzaluna means half moon, by the way.
Yes.
Which is beautiful. Like, I think it was the right move. I disagree. Like, I think that was the right move. The problem, no one at that judge's table took offense to her making pasta.
You're right.
I mean, what they took offense to was, hey, radicchio in the old world is really bitter in a way that it isn't when you get it, like, kind of, you know, charred here in, like, a salad, or, you know, like, with a nice dash of vinegar. Like, it's just a different ball game over there. So, I mean, I would disagree. Like, I think Gregory made a dish that was entirely Gregory. Maybe that was the problem, is he tends to go for these sort of deep flavors, which are going to compete. You know, Kevin's was interesting. He got screwed by having the multiple meats.
Yeah.
So it just, this is not the first time I feel like on the show, and I can't recall, maybe Vince can remember. I just feel like someone else has gotten the old curveball from going to the grocery in a non-English speaking country and, you know, not getting what they thought they were getting. I feel like I've seen that before, and I was kind of trying to go through my old notes and I couldn't find it, but I feel like, let's talk about the winners, because, you know, I mentioned it earlier. It's not a coincidence that the chefs with the two cleanest styles excelled here. Voltaggio, hey, I'm going to braise a veal shank with truffle, chestnuts, which are a wonderfully sort of a lovely accent, but they're not going to, you know, bowl you over. And then I'm going to do this potato foam with the little melted truffle in it. And it's just, that was it. And it was his cleanliness that allowed him to shine. And same thing with Melissa. I mean, congee is just such a blank. I mean, it looks like a canvas. And it's just this kind of this, there's this white purity to it. You know, I'm going to do some fried garlic, quail egg. Apparently she didn't need the salami. And then I'm going to use both truffle butter and sort of and truffles themselves. And it's not a coincidence. Like, these were the two chefs that got it.
Is congee like kind of like grits almost? I guess it's porridge. It's a rice porridge.
Yeah. Sorry. It's great. Like, I always see it at like dim sum where they come around with a big pot and the ladle and And
that screams truffle to me. She's so brilliant. Right. You know, like her and Voltaggio doing that kind of like potatoy base or a grain base to highlight the truffle, I think it's just brilliant. Like when I saw the potato foam or that dish that Voltaggio presented, I was like, yes, I want that. Like, I can even taste the truffle when he presented that. So, you know, I think Melissa is just rolling. You know, she is 5 wins, and in 3 of those wins, she also won the quick fire on that day, or at least placed in the quick fire that day. And I would be stunned if she doesn't win this whole damn thing. I'm kind of in my head a little bit because I have seen the trailer for like when Padma says, you are top chef. She gets like overly exuberant. Like, she's
this is Myrick's theory. He is convinced it's Melissa because the manner in which she says you are top chef is so clearly either an expression of.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer. And I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep. Free shipping, vacuum sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got 2 cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodles is like,
Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
You girl, or yes. Hey, somebody who's just had this sort of Cinderella ride. Like, it's not a manner in which she would convey to, say, Kevin Gillespie or Voltaggio even. Oh, like, there's a level – that is – Eric had this theory when he first saw the thing, and I'm absolutely convinced he's correct and you're correct.
What? See, I agree with Eric, and we'll probably bring this up with Vince here in a few minutes, but I think it's also, what if it's Steph? What if it's Steph?
I mean, let's talk about her for a second. I mean, I know she ended up on the bottom with the Ridicchio issue, but she has been one of the best stories of this competition for now over a month. And she is cooking with some confidence, not overwhelming confidence. She is somebody still prone to doubt herself.
Yes,
she's
yes.
Very self-deprecating. But I feel like she is now going into these challenges saying, I've got a plan. And I think she knows what she does well. Again, I like the decision to make pasta, irrespective of what one of the patrons said. And because she does it well. I mean, she makes good pasta. She has not had anything other than resounding success making pasta. And I suspect it will not be the last time she makes pasta in Italy. But she's become one of the great stories. She is the unqualified underdog as we enter the final four.
Kevin, the final four. You have two chefs. I have two chefs. I've got Melissa, 71 points. Kevin is on your team with 52. That's a huge gap. Voltaggio on my team with 42 points, and Stephanie just behind him at 39. So we both have two chefs. You were thrown in the towel early in this fantasy challenge that we have. And Kevin, I got to say, I'm super nervous. Gregory is off the board, does not finish in the final four.
You're ahead by 67 points.
No. I'm not saying in the whole. I'm just looking in the terms of.
What are we giving the overall winner, by the way?
I believe it's 25 points.
Okay.
So you still have to make up serious ground here. Yeah. But in terms of who's going to have the winning chef on their team, judging by Padma's reaction, I think it's a girl. And we're going to go and we're going to talk about this with Vince here in a second. Any last thoughts before we get into our interview with the top chef ranking, power ranking man?
No, this is exciting. I'm still just it's going to be very strange next week to turn on the show and not have Gregory be there. I don't know that it's so much it shocked me. Obviously, it shocked me, but I think its lasting effects that his absence won't be felt until he's truly absent. We're going to turn on, they're going to do that. They're going to be rousing out of bed, and it's like he's not going to be there, and like that's going to be strange.
You know what? I think we're going to get not a Michael Jordan "I'm back" moment, but we're going to see Gregory again because he's already over there
or something. This is not the same.
I want Stephanie and Gregory on a team again. I want to see that again. Let's bring on Vince Mancini. We are ready to roll here. We're not on video, so you don't have to do video, but yet you have a wonderful mustache. I just wanted
Thank
to say.
You. Thank you.
Let's roll here with this right off the top, Vince. Mm-hmm. Gregory is not on Top Chef anymore. He does not finish in the final four. Was this as shocking to you, Vince, as the guy who is the proprietor of Top Chef rankings at UpRocks? He was probably, one or two throughout your entire power ranking season, and now he's gone.
Yeah, I don't think he was ever lower than two. So, shocked, disappointed, a little sad, kind of bitter maybe a little bit. I feel like he kind of got hosed by the structure of the show a little bit this week.
What do you mean by that? Because I think it was just an injury. I think it was just he had back issues and he was like, I can't do this.
Right. But I mean, it's kind of like the NFL where it's like, yeah, where you have, 18 games and people are inevitably going to get injured. I mean, at least the way they made it look, they flew directly from L.A. to Italy and just threw him into a challenge right away. And man, if you have a bad back and you fly across the ocean and then you start working right away, that's pretty bad.
Kevin, I think in Vince's write up for this week, he mentioned that he's looking for a bacchiotomy. And you, Kevin, you're also coming off a back surgery in the recent times, and it's a successful one. So Kevin, Vince, you have the floor on back issues and the sympathy you have for.
All right. So Vince, which segment are we looking at? Is this like lumbar? Are you L3, L4? Which year?
Oh no, it's lower back. I haven't needed surgery, but I've been I've been managing with some stretching and yoga and all that.
I'm a huge practitioner of yoga, but I will tell you the microdiscectomy changed my life.
What is that?
Like, you're in and out in 45 minutes. They basically stick a laser in your frigging spine, shave off whatever the hell's wrong, or kind of decompress the. I mean, I have lower back issues. I was L3, L4, L4, L5. I was freaking walking 4 days later. It's insanely. This is like freaking science that didn't exist 25 years ago. And it was just like, I mean, it was like infinitely easier than a hernia surgery. Like, it was just like, I was down for a few days. Dare I say, it wasn't even all that, like, the recovery wasn't even all that painful. Like, I don't know, man. Talk to your orthopedist. I am an evangelist now for the microdiscectomy.
Is this SponCon? Are you affiliated, or is this completely?
I have no endorsements, affiliations. I'm just kind of a fanatic. I'm like doing shit again. I ran a half marathon 5 months later. It was just like, so I highly recommend it.
I mean, I've been hesitant to look into any surgical solutions because I'm afraid someone's going to Steve Kerr my ass. But, that sounds like it might be a possibility.
By the way, there's nobody more like pissy about Steve Kerr than the orthopedic surgery community. Because like the minute I said, like when he first proposed it, I'm like, yeah, I don't want to end up like Steve Kerr. And it took my orthopedist all – like he's a cool dude, and he was just like, and he's just come all the discipline in the world not to be like, you motherfucker, Steve Kerr. He's like, no, what Steve Kerr had was X. What we're talking about is Y. I was like, all right.
Microdiscectomy. I'll have to write that down and take it to someone who knows.
Vince, you've been doing these power rankings for how many years?
Ooh, I should have researched this before I came on. I want to say three, four years.
Why did you start doing it?
I love Top Chef. I'm like a fanatic. I always watch it. And I just was looking for – it's just a fun thing to write every week. Like, it doesn't take the kind of brain power that other things do. And I kind of just get to like riff and make jokes. And it's kind of like helped me to rediscover – 2009, 2010 blogging, where it's just, I'm writing just like, like weekend update jokes practically. I'm just basically like writing short humor, which I enjoy more than doing the hard stuff naturally.
It feels like firejoemorgan.com when Michael Schur was writing that. It's just like every one you write, I just giggle at your nicknames, some of the call outs you make. I'm like, oh yes, he's thinking that too. And one of the things that Kevin and I were discussing just a few minutes ago, and I don't know if you've hit on this in your power rankings, but have you seen the trailer for the finale, where at least in the future, coming soon on Top Chef, where Padma says, "You are Top Chef," and she just gets super excited and like kind of bowls over her emotions and says it. Kevin's partner, Eric, he was saying, I think that was kind of a tell on who wins Top Chef, how excited Padma was. Did you read into that at all?
Oh, I don't think that specific promo was at the end of my, because I'm watching like the press cut. I don't want to brag or anything, but
wait, hold on.
Holy What a flex.
Tom,
why the fuck do we have the press cut?
Wait a minute.
I have to sit around like a civilian until Thursday night watching my clock. Ooh, it's almost dawn on regular civilian television. What the fuck? How do we
when are you
have
getting
a press
these
cut?
Episodes?
They've literally threatened to sue me for $1 million if I share it. So I don't even know if I'm allowed to talk about the existence of it. I might have already broken some rules.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
You might not have seen. Yeah. Wait. So you're completely in the dark on this. You don't watch the promos for the following episodes.
It might not. I don't think it came up on the. I don't think it was in my screening cut. I don't think. There's been a couple times where like one little thing someone brings up and I'm like, oh, I don't think I saw that in my version of it. So maybe I need to start doing my rewatch on the actual cable box.
Okay. Man, this is a revelation, Kevin. I don't know if we'll ever recover from this. We got to talk to the Bravo folks. Maybe offline, Vince, you'll spill the goods.
Oh yeah.
Your interpretation of Shenanigans, as you call him, Brian Mullarkey, the heel of this season. Did you come around on him like Kevin did this year?
Yeah, I have to admit that I did. So, I mean, it was funny because I got to attend. I'm doing the flex again, and I apologize. But I got to attend when they did Restaurant Wars, and he was the front of the house. So like I actually saw him, and I knew who he was, and I recognized him. So like I knew he was there, and I had a pretty good experience with that. But then it was like 6 months before the season started, and I think I initially reacted just like anyone else watching the show, where this guy, he's just one of those guys that has like an unsettling personality where from like 30 or 40 yards away, you kind of look at him and go, okay, this guy's a lot and I'm going to keep my distance, you know?
Mm.
And, but then, you know, but then I did come around and I think there was like a conspiracy theory, with him going home in last episode with the whole thing where they said they didn't get some of his dishes. Did you guys get into that at all?
No.
I mean, yeah, but I mean, they made it so clear that it just wasn't a factor in their ultimate judgment. And I kind of believe them. Like, I mean, the shit didn't taste good. Actually, it's like the old joke. Like, the food is so bad and in such small portions. Like, I mean, like if there were more of it on the table, it would have been, you know, better.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything in the season has been like the person doing something that they know is a bad idea and then they do it anyway, which was
the Radicchio. You know, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So he did the duo, which he knew was a bad idea to begin with. But like a couple people sent me like conspiracy theories, basically, where they said that they sent him back to the kitchen to try and figure out where his missing entrees were. And then they didn't let him come back out and describe the thing that he made, which he did actually have instructions that went with that. And there's even like a clip where it looks like Brooke sent his food back deliberately. But I don't think I'm
wait,
that,
wait, wait,
I don't
wait,
think I'm wait. That conspiratorial, but it does exist.
Wait, so breakdown. So was Top Chef sabotaging him? What's the conspiracy here?
I definitely don't think it was deliberate sabotage, but I don't know. The conspiracy theorists, they make it look like she sent it back and then blamed it on him for some reason.
Interesting.
I really started taking to him because I appreciate the heel role and he's sort of Top Chef's most postmodern chef / contestant ever, but also because he just so clearly amuses Padma in a way that Padma is not a woman easily amused. Like, this is not a woman you can charm or amuse, and yet
he amuses Padma. And then I loved he's got like three words into his dish description and Tom was immediately like rolling his eyes and sighing. He makes Tom exhausted and it's enjoyable to watch.
And then I was totally overwhelmed when Flam told us that, like, I mean, we don't know the number, but and I think Padma or Tom made reference to it too, that like he's worth all three of us combined. I mean, he's just there. So there's this funny power dynamic where he is this obsequious, like annoying, always freaking selling his food, and yet like the guy's worth like tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, someone actually a Top Chef chef testant texted me and said, did you see Malarkey is donating his fan favorite bonus if he wins to a charity? No, all of us chefs are broke. We need that $10,000. And I was like, oh, and I think actually Melissa came out this week and said she was doing something similar, that she was going to donate to charity if she wins fan favorite. And there's, I think, a $10,000 prize for that. And I think there is this kind of undercurrent of not resentment, but just kind of annoyance of the fact that he didn't need to be there for his own like business side. Maybe he likes the publicity of coming on to Top Chef, but there was kind of when he was at that judges table of like, I don't need this. You know what? I'm going to pack my knives and go home. I'm going to fall on that and just go home. I'm good.
Yeah. It was funny. Like to me, if he would have actually walked out of there, it would have been more warranted. In that case, like when Kevin did the fall on his sword thing, he did like a huge speech about what a great guy he was first. I felt like Malarkey is slightly more relatable in the sense that he was just like, no, you guys kind of screwed me over in this one. I don't need this and I'm upset. I'm going to leave, which I don't know. The Kevin's thing where he like grandstanded and then everybody just took what everything that he said at face value was kind of annoying to me.
Oh, see, Kevin, you're head over heels for that, right? Because it's the Atlanta bond.
Yeah, I'm sort of in the tank for Kevin just because, like, I'm from Atlanta. He's from Atlanta. I love his food in Atlanta. And yeah, but so I was thinking about this the other day, Vince. Mm-hmm. We've done 17 seasons, right? So there are going to have been 17 winners. At what point does Top Chef say, like, season 20,
ooh,
we are only inviting chefs that have won a season for the ultimate, like, to me, this is my fantasy as a viewer and a fan. I wonder if those chefs are too busy, don't need it, are not going to, like, and then, like, I'm not going to sleep in freaking bunk beds for 9 weeks. You know, like, but this is, to me, the thing I want more than anything is a season where it is just – Your admission to this season, the prerequisite is you must have won your season.
Mm, yeah,
like the Jeopardy goat.
Yeah, exactly.
The Jeopardy champions. Yeah,
I mean, I think it's funny because it's clear that this show still has such an impact on the chef's business that, I mean, this season, it's all people that are theoretically already pretty well established, and some of them are pretty rich, and they're still doing it because clearly, like, if you're on the show, it has such an impact on your business that I feel like if they invited back all the winners would probably still do it. Like, they never seem like they have trouble getting people to come back.
Yeah, this is what I want more than anything.
So Kevin, yeah, because Joe Flam, when he was on our show a few weeks ago, he was saying that one of the things about Top Chef All-Stars that's different is that they're kind of these polished, they already understand the gamut, like the whole confessional, they mastered that to not to reveal too much. Have you felt that, Vince, this season is there's kind of, we've lost a little bit of that grittiness and that raw of these up and coming prospect chefs just really desperate to win this thing. Whereas this year it's just kind of more, I don't know, safer confessionals, or I guess polished confessionals.
I don't know that it bothers me that they have learned the game in terms of cooking, but definitely you just in interviewing some of these chefs like you guys have done, like I think I definitely notice a difference between interviewing them at the beginning of a season and at the end, just from the experience of having cameras on them all the time and being interviewed all the time. Like, they get so media polished by the end that there's such a practiced spontaneity by the end. It's kind of like athletes when they get interviewed and they immediately go into like athlete cliche mode. I don't think any of the chefs are too cliche, but they definitely, I feel like there's you definitely sense the polish now more than you did at the beginning, and it might take away from the candor a little bit.
You went to Restaurant Wars.
Yes.
Give us the goods. Like, what are some of the things you couldn't write that you want to share on our pod? Go.
ooh, the things that I couldn't write. I don't know that there were. I don't know that there is things that I couldn't write.
What were some of the coolest that we went to Restaurant Wars 2 years ago in Lexington, Kentucky, and it was really, really interesting because we didn't know any of the chefs. We didn't really know the personalities. But I guess you said you recognized Brian Mullarkey. Did you recognize all the others?
I did recognize Brian Mullarkey, and I didn't see too many other people. I don't know if I just missed them or they weren't there. I saw Karen, and I recognized her, but I couldn't place her like I could Mullarkey. But yeah, I think those were the only two because they were at the front of the house. I didn't actually see anybody else. And
did you get drunk like we did?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was like 3 hours, and you know, it was like 45 minutes to get the apps. And I don't know if you guys were. I was there by myself, sitting with like a group of media people that I didn't know, and so you know, I was just throwing them back, trying to get comfortable. I don't know if it was like that for you guys.
Yeah, they just gave us like a bottle of rosé. They were apologizing because we just were late and waiting in line for so long, and it was the heat of summer in Kentucky. It was a good time, but I remember just Kevin and I cover the NBA, and I don't get these many of these moments of being starstruck by when like LeBron walks by or Stephen Curry or whoever it is. But when Padma walked in, I was just like, oh my God, there she is. And she had these like makeup people just like perfecting her hair and her makeup. And I just was so starstruck. I was like, oh my God, she's right there. And who was it? Someone was mentioning that the people who serve first on Restaurant Wars, they get like when the chefs, the judges come to your table, the second team to serve actually are at a disadvantage because all the people who are eating at that restaurant are waiting around for the judges to show up.
Mm-hmm.
And so they get backed up on their service because the tables just won't leave until Tom and Padma and Gail show up. So did you come away from Restaurant Wars being like, that was about what I expected, or what were the coolest things about
that? The food was better than I expected. I mean, the most memorable thing was just having Brian Mullarkey as a server where, I mean, he actually used that exact excuse, like, oh, you guys got stuck behind the judges. And so when he came over to apologize, like, he's just a lot. Like, I don't know how to describe him other than that he's so extra. He talks like, you know, 4 inches from your face, makes like very direct eye contact. He's always like putting his hand on your back or like your arm. And he was just a lot. But then he was also going on about how we were on island time. And I have to admit, like, it was crazy how much that worked. Maybe it's because, you know, I had like four rum cocktails by that point, but I was like, oh yeah, we are on island time. I don't care that it took me 2.5 hours to have lunch.
Vince, you actually don't run into that many Top Chef fanatics in life. What works about the show for you most fundamentally? Why are you into it the way we're into it?
I think I'm into it because there is an allowance for letting things happen. I think a lot of, non-scripted television, like, they have a very specific format and they stick to it no matter what happens, and they squeeze anything that happens into their format. Like, I think Top Chef does allow for a certain amount of spontaneity and they kind of roll with it. But I like the judges a lot. They don't strike me as phony. Like, Tom to Colicchio is really on his shit, and you can sense that Tom Colicchio has very little patience for like contrived drama, and I think that sort of extends across the whole show, and it makes it feel more real and more natural somehow. And I like how they don't overplay the human interest angles like you would expect in some of these shows. Like, they do it a little bit, but I think Melissa mentioned her sexuality like in passing on this last episode, and they just let it go at that. It was like, yeah, cool. Like, that's like, they don't beat you over the head with plot points.
Doesn't seem contrived, right?
Doesn't seem contrived.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What's brilliant about it is they don't do that yet. I feel like I fundamentally know who these people are. Like, they're able to kind of just let their behavior and their their sort of selfhood come through with their cooking and just their manner. Like, I mean, that's what's great is, I mean, you never want to say you don't care about the home life of a contestant on a reality show, because it's pretty callous. But at the end of the day, like, I mean, at the end of the day, like, get back to the cooking, right? Like get back to the competition. And I don't think you have to be a callous person to want that. It's not that I don't care about people talking to their spouses at home. And a really good story is a really good story. But you're right. Like, they are able to kind of achieve that.
And like every reality show has the moment where the person goes on a Skype call with their kids, and then there's like 5 minutes of them crying because they haven't seen their kids in like, you know, 8 days or whatever. And honestly, like, shut up. I don't care. I don't. Like, it's great, but you don't need to waste screen time on it. We get it.
This episode had a lot of American Airlines and Peroni. A lot of American Airlines and Peroni.
They Kevin, do such a good job with product placement. Like, no wonder this show does well.
Yeah, they'll sometimes have like the Whirlpool like logo, and they're like just like showing like a dishwasher or something like that. I'm like, oh wait, I think they just did that. I think it was a product placement. They do an amazing job of having story arcs throughout the season where you're playing up how Stephanie is self-deprecating and she has the best one-liners on the show, and you know, nowhere in the early on episodes would you imagine that Stephanie would have been in the top four. So there's not a lot of giveaways in this show. I guess they got this down pat, is that they've got this figured out. So they sometimes you think that because they do those little home life callbacks, the FaceTimes with Leanne and his and her family or Malarkey with the birthday, you're like, oh, they're going home. But sometimes they just catch you off guard. And I just don't think, if you watch the first 8 episodes of this season, you would expect Stephanie to be in the finals. But here she is. You call her the sea monster. Do you think the sea monster has a real shot at winning this thing?
I mean, there's always the question of like how much track record counts in Top Chef. Like, they kind of make it out like they're judging it based strictly on the single previous challenge. But you know that like track record has to come into play a little bit. I don't see her winning. No. She seems great, but she seems like she always makes the one unforced error that keeps her from winning, from stringing together like more than one win at a time.
We have a point system on our fantasy standings here. Melissa has 71 points this season. Kevin is at 52. Voltaggio is at 42. And Stephanie's at 39. Based on those standings, who's the most underrated on that board? Do you think Kevin or Voltaggio or Stephanie is most underrated?
I don't know. Is anyone underrated? I guess maybe Voltaggio, but it's hard to say because, I mean, Voltaggio obviously does well with anything that's more like upscale, which is why he can just keep losing quick fires and still is always in the top one or two or three at the end.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Like, he doesn't give a shit about the quick fires. It doesn't appeal to his sensibility. He's not a guy who's going to throw shit together in 20 minutes. He doesn't do it in his regular life, and he's certainly not going to do it here. And I'm with you. Like, I think he's got a technicality to his cooking that as you get into these more elaborate finale meals where it's not like, hey, tonight, chef, you're going to blindfold you and you're going to cook underwater with only the ingredients you can find in the cooler of a guy's pickup truck. But if it's just like, here's this opulent, beautiful, sort of like, go pick your meat and like, here's 7 hours. I think he's a sleeper for that reason.
I also don't think Stephanie's underrated because I think this show favors people, chefs that have like a specific point of view. And like, I know what Brian Voltaggio's point of view is. I know what Kevin's point of view is. I know what Gregory's point of view is. I know what Melissa's point. I even know like Jen Carroll and some of the people that were eliminated earlier. I don't really have a strong sense of what kind of food I would get if I went to Stephanie's restaurant.
That's a good point.
It was the pub food, right?
Right. Yeah.
it was the schnitzel.
It was like I'm doing American contemporary, modernized comfort food or something like. It was like 10 different versions of things we've heard a million times.
And she's still here. It's great. Okay, so Melissa, it seems like she's the overwhelming favorite. Kevin comes back on Last Chance. Voltaggio is Voltaggio, and fascinatingly terrible at speaking Italian. And I'm really excited for the next couple episodes, and I think we're going to see more Gregory here. Maybe we'll get some, you know, vindication from the back injury. He just looked miserable on this episode, man. I feel so bad for him.
Yeah, that was a bummer.
It was Pippin-esque, yeah.
All right, any last thoughts? Any picks that you'd like to make here, Vince, for the rest of the Top Chef season?
I mean, I would like to see more Italians complain about the types and ways that people are cooking pasta, because like Italians being mad about food is one of my favorite things. And we got a little bit about that, but I would like to see more. I wish we had like three more episodes.
Yes. Yeah. We're kind of clamoring for Kevin and I have discussed about like a Top Chef Uncut, where they just have a lot more of the judges just being critical of their food. I would definitely watch that show.
Mortified Italians is a great subgenre of person. And I think mortified Italians, I'm with you. Like that's something I want to see more of.
Just like the confused, like where they just have a sense that, you know, you don't make this pasta shape with that kind of meat and it's just not done. And how dare you? That's
or never cook salami ever again. Yeah. Like wholesale condemnation, not like, yeah, a little misstep. It's like you shall never, ever again cook this meat.
They really did a good job structuring those like they were, you know, heart to hearts or like they were going to say something nice. And they're like, please don't ever cook no pasta for us again. We're so tired of a pasta. Please, no more.
poor Stephanie was like, I'm going to cook pasta. And then she just gets roasted for cooking a beautiful pasta. Oh, poor thing. Yeah, we need to find out more about this white truffle industry, Kevin.
I am convinced, Vince, that there is like, I'm sorry, there isn't an asset in the world that is $3,000 a pound where there isn't like some underworld, like shady ass, like just black market. I mean, I need to find out more about the white truffle undermark.
There's a great – I just saw a documentary at Sundance called The Truffle Hunters. It's not out yet. And there were parts of it where people were actually like poisoning each other's dogs to keep them off of
their
truffle fields. This is what I'm talking about.
And so – and then I was just reading a Reddit thread about how much – someone estimated that they used like 20 grand worth of truffles in that show, which I'm not good enough at math to do that. But that was interesting.
That would be like 6 pounds.
Yeah, yeah. And another person who emailed me was wondering why they wear camouflage when they're hunting for truffles. Because like, what are you going to do? Scare the truffles away?
Oh my god! Yeah, like we need to know more about this. How many do you scour like the Top Chef Reddit? I don't do much of that before I do these pods. What is your Top Chef routine like? Is it watching twice? Oh, you got the goods. You get the presser screener. So you get that. And then how many emails do you get? How many people reach out to you? Do you have a text chain with people?
I hadn't delved into the Reddit before today, but I heard about the malarkey conspiracy, and I wanted to bone up and see what people were actually saying. And so I just delved into some of the Reddits, and I immediately kind of went down a couple rabbit holes. So I might be back. But my general routine is I watch it once and I take notes on who's winning what challenges and what people cooked, and then I try to watch it again. Just, you know, like to experience it like a regular viewer. And that's pretty much it, you know, and then I read the comments and read the response, the tweet replies and all that stuff.
I feel like there's like a million people who watch this show every week. And I feel like, how is there not more media coverage from people like you and Kevin and I? It's just, I love this show. And I think it's just, I can't believe that there isn't more of us out there, which makes us great. It makes us, you know, have a bigger, larger platform, I guess, in some ways. But I love this show, and I'm so glad we were able to have you on this week.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys having me. It was fun. Yeah, I don't get to actually talk about it out loud very often. Mostly I just have to write it down and hope people read. It was fun, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Thanks, Vince. Thanks for stopping by.
Anytime.
It's great. Enjoy the final the final stretch.
Likewise.
Vince, we will we'll catch up soon. Maybe we'll circle back once this season's over. But for those who aren't aware about the Top Chef rankings on Up Rocks. Vince Mancini, it cracks me up every week. It is so good. You got to read it. And all, where can they find your work elsewhere?
You can find me on Up Rocks, and I have two podcasts, the Film Drunk Frotcast, which is like my movies and comedy. And then I have one that's about The Sopranos, which is called Pod Yourself a Gun. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Vince Mancini on Twitter.
For Tom Haberstroh and for Vince Mancini, this is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.